You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hastened by sluggish productivity growth, the once unfashionable idea of a centrally planned industrial strategy is back on the political agenda in Britain. But will it have the desired effect? Joining me today is the IEA's Head of Transport, Dr. Richard Wellings, along with our Head of Tech Policy, Diego Zuluaga. The pair take a look at how industrial strategies have historically fared around the world and examine the extent to which we can rely on the free market to deliver the infrastructure we need and where government should fit into all this. They also address HS2, one of the most controversial investment projects of recent years. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. The Nobel laureate Paul Krugman has recently said that productivity is not everything, but in the long run, it is almost everything. Diego, I'll start with you. Is Paul Krugman right? And should we therefore consider Britain's low productivity as a crisis?
Well, I think the reason why Krugman puts such emphasis on productivity is that it is responsible, this indicator is responsible for rising welfare over time. Now, of course, we know that in the short term, increasing the amount of capital and the amount of labor in the economy can increase output. But it is only really through innovation and increasingly efficient production methods that we achieve measurable increases in welfare and allow for an increasing population to be able to increase its standard of living over an extended period of time. It's probably worth defining what productivity is. So when economists talk about productivity, they generally refer to the efficiency with which a certain resource is used. And there are two types of productivity measurements that are commonly used in statistics. The first one is labor productivity, which is the ratio of output to hours worked, so GDP over the number of hours worked in an economy. And the second measure of productivity is called total factor productivity. Now, this sounds very technical, but it basically just is what remains after you account for increasing capital and increasing labor. Once you account for that and the rest of the increase in GDP over a certain period of time that is not explained either by capital or by labor, that's called an increase in total factor productivity, basically the efficiency with which whatever capital and labor you've got are being used to produce output.
I see. Richard, can you tell us a little bit about why British productivity in particular is considered to be so low?
Well, it's not particularly low on a global level. It's actually rather high, but nonetheless, it is lower than in several other G7 economies. And I think it's an interesting question to explain that. I think in the sort of medium term over the last few years, we have seen pretty poor productivity growth in the UK. I think that might be partly due to certain sectors declining in their role in the economy. So, for example, we've seen a decline in gas and oil output, and they were very high productivity sectors. We've also seen the key financial services sector hamstrung by raft upon raft of hugely expensive regulations. So there are now vast compliance departments to ensure that companies are following rules and regulations. And also, there is an argument that with low interest rates and the bailouts, you have got a large number of zombie firms in the UK economies aren't really investing. They're just limping along, and that's acting as a drag on productivity growth. But it's a bit of a mystery. I think there are numerous factors at play here.
I wholeheartedly agree with Richard. And I think it's worth raising the issue that, labour productivity, to take the most common measurement of this, that is, as I said, GDP over hours worked. Now, it isn't therefore necessarily a bad thing that productivity wouldn't increase so fast. In the UK, what we've seen since the crisis is that employment has actually reached records. The employment rate is at record levels. Now, for more hours worked in a given level of output, you would therefore expect productivity to be lower than otherwise. In the sort of in a similar way, or in mirror fashion, in Spain, which had a very bad economic crisis and where unemployment increased to 26% of the labor force in 2012-2013, you've seen actually quite vast increases in productivity. But that, of course, is no indicator of rising welfare. So in the short term, productivity measurements are not necessarily unambiguous in what they suggest to us. That's why Krugman says in the long run, productivity is everything. In the long run, we want productivity to be as high as possible. However, the determinants of it are not necessarily always benign or always malign.
So in some ways, if we wanted to improve productivity, it wouldn't necessarily be a case of investing in certain industries. It might also be a case of picking very specific ones that seem to be aligned with higher productivity.
Well, yeah, if you were sort of trying to centrally plan the economy to boost the figures, that would be the case. But I mean, I think the problem here is you've also got just the sheer scale of regulation these days and high taxes. There, effectively ossifying parts of the economy, you get these what are called distributional coalitions that in areas, particularly areas where the government is playing a large role, like health and education, they actually act as a brake on innovation that would increase productivity. So the teaching unions say, oh, well, we don't want any more automation. Or the, you know, the medical guilds, the doctors' guilds don't introduce, if you like, mass production in healthcare. So you do have these big brakes on productivity growth from various special interest groups, and that's hugely harmful to the economy.
And by the sounds of it, measures that would lay off a lot of people would probably be great for productivity. So it's a poison chalice, potentially.
Well, look at France, which has a very high minimum wage and therefore excludes all the low productivity people from the labour force. And as a result of that, its productivity per worker looks much better than the UK's. But of course, once you account for the fact that you have a labour market that is segmented and a lot of people at the lower end of the income scale who are simply not able to access the labour market, you realise that it's no indicator of higher welfare than workers would have in this country.
So the most recent data from Britain shows quite a sharp uptick. The last quartile figures were the biggest improvement in output per hour for 6 years. Do you think we could now be on the verge of some kind of breakthrough with productivity?
I don't think so. I think this might just be a blip, because I think that there are long-term problems with the UK economy, particularly as it's so heavily regulated and there are such massive barriers to productivity enhancing innovations. I mean, this may partly be due to a reduction in low-paid workers coming to the UK from the EU, but I think it's too early to say. There are probably numerous factors at work, and that wouldn't necessarily be a good thing for economic output as a whole. It might just be flattering the productivity statistics in the short term.
Yes, yeah, so it's one data point. It's difficult to draw statistical conclusions from that. But then also, secondly, it is worth mentioning that unemployment is now very low. And therefore, as Richard was saying, you know, not being able to hire necessarily at existing wage levels. Employers might be looking to replace some labour with capital or might be willing to pay higher wages. And that would be reflected in the figures just because of the way that output is measured in the economy.
From what you've said, Richard, a lot of the obstacles to high productivity seem to come from the state with regulations and so on. Is there any place for the state in all of this to resolve the productivity crisis?
Generally, it's a bad idea because governments aren't very good at behaving like business people and trying to improve efficiency in firms. I mean, this sort of extreme examples, there may be cases, for example, where a government is needed to steal land to build, say, a transport scheme that improves productivity. But that, then again, that has quite negative knock-on effects in terms of security of people's property and private property rights that could damage investments in the longer term, in the sense that if people don't feel as if their property is secure, then they're not going to invest in it. But there may be some niche sectors where the government could play a role, but yeah, they're fairly few and far between.
Can we always rely on the private sector to provide things like large-scale infrastructure projects, things that might take a long time to build, and they might have gains that might take a few years to really show themselves? Is that necessarily in the interest of the private sector to support those projects?
Well, it's a myth that the private sector doesn't think long term. I mean, there are plenty of examples. The classic one is investment in forestry, where, of course, the trees take decades and decades to grow, and yet it's functioning perfectly well in the private sector. And also, of course, don't forget that the private sector built the UK rail system as well in the 19th century. So there's no real barrier to that. And of course, the problem is if governments get involved, it gets very political. So MPs will say, all right, I want the new roads here, I want the new railway in my constituency. And then you get a lot of really rubbish schemes that are poor value for money. So you're better off leave it to entrepreneurs.
Yeah. And also, I think politicians have a natural instinct to want legacy projects so that they can clearly point to their 10 years as an MP for this place and say, I achieved this, I did this thing. Might be a terrible use of taxpayers' money, but it's there and it's perhaps a bit glamour than doing something like road improvements.
Exactly. They love a glamorous vanity project, and that's why we have things like HS2, which is really poor value for money, instead of, you know, building, say, a few hundred bypasses that would deliver far better benefits for the economy.
So as part of their our efforts to try and raise productivity, the government has revived this once very unfashionable idea of industrial strategy. Diego, can you tell me a little bit about the origins of this way of thinking and why it's now back in?
Well, industrial strategy is basically as old as government intervention in the economy. There's always been a notion among the people in government that they can shape the particular manufacturers and industries that operate in a country, and whatever is fashionable at any given point in time becomes what governments wish to encourage. So you see this in Germany at the turn of the century, that is the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. But then it really became applied internationally in very many different contexts in the interwar period. So with the Great Depression, you had a lot of state intervention in industrial policy in the United States. In Western Europe, during this time, obviously, fascism was an ideology that defended industrial intervention in the economic realm, not least to protect domestic firms from foreign competition, because there was the whole economically nationalist agenda that they pursued. And then in Western Europe afterwards, during the age when, you know, what's called the Keynesian sort of demand management era, industrial policy was very high on the agenda because it was perceived that particular industries were particularly desirable. It would contribute to growth more than others. Now, the record of industrial policy is very flimsy everywhere, and it's particularly poor in the United Kingdom. Over the 1960s and 70s that the UK economy really sputtered and trend growth rates began to decline. That had to do with a lot of different factors, of course, but certainly one of them was the extensive involvement of the government in trying to determine outcomes, and therefore the way in which the decisions of competing entrepreneurs were affected by that. And obviously, you know, trade unionism is part of this industrial policy because you often necessitate the collaboration of workers to achieve the goals that government wants to pursue, and that trade union activism also hindered. That's where the notion of industrial policy comes from. That's why its reputation in the UK up until recently was not very good, because there was the institutional memory of that time. But now a mixture of the political climate, the economic circumstances after the crash, and also I think some political opportunism have led to its rising again up the agenda. And, you know, these are notions that give governments a very prominent position, and so politicians really like this idea that they can actually shape outcomes in the way that they wish.
It is essentially a rebranding of this very, very old idea, but they have kind of glammed it up in the 21st century in Britain. They've created a new department, I think it's Business, Energy, Industrial Strategy, and they have people like the economist Mariana Mazzucato constantly on the news defending this idea. Is contemporary industrial strategy very different to the forms that you've been talking about? Or, you know, is it still basically picking winners?
Well, it's interesting because Mariana Mazzucato's book, The Entrepreneurial State, which was published by a UK think tank, Demos, before it became a bestseller in its own right, it basically looks at one industrial policy in one time period, which is the United States after World War II. And of course, this is a time when a lot of research and development spending was happening through the government because of Cold War fears that the Soviet Union would overtake the US in its technological wherewithal. And so, you know, up to 50 or 60% of research and development spending was done by the state at this time. So it's not surprising that some of that spending would result in things that have very much later on led to innovations that are beneficial today. That's just the law, what's called in statistics, the law of large numbers. You know, even if you invest completely randomly across projects, you will get some to succeed. Now, Mariana Mazzucato does a very good job of pointing to the case studies where such spending has been successful. But there are two things that we should keep in mind. First of all, that there are tons of other projects that never came to anything. And then secondly, that oftentimes it was purely the government throwing money at different things rather than in any sort of strategic or systematic fashion, deciding which things might be successful and which might not. So the actual wisdom of the government in undertaking this activity is highly questionable. And of course, we just have evidence from one country. It's interesting that Mazzucato, being of Italian descent, wouldn't look at the record of industrial policy in Italy, which is much spottier because of governance issues there and rule of law issues there. You would find that if you do a worldwide cross-section of the experience of industrial policy, you find an even less auspicious picture.
Yeah, exactly right there. The advocates of industrial policy always pick particularly favourable examples. They also look at some of these East Asian tigers. The fact is, in a sense, they developed despite all this intervention, not because of it. And they had all the economic tides flowing in the right direction anyway, with these huge economies of scale and so on they could capture in that particular region and the low labour costs. So it was more about freeing up things like trade and getting rid of a lot of the regulation. That's what boosted these economies, not these politicians trying to pick winners. And there are so many disaster stories from industrial strategy. I mean, over and over again in country after country, in the UK alone, our politicians since the Second World War have wasted hundreds of billions of pounds in today's money on these daft schemes, and it's crowded out private sector investment and been hugely economically damaging.
What did we do before we had industrial strategy?
Well, if you look back at the 19th century, then private entrepreneurs would invest in major infrastructure projects. Effectively, they'd aim to make a profit. If you look back at George Stephenson, 1825, the Stockton to Darlington first modern-style railway, George Stephenson realised he could dramatically reduce the cost of shifting coal from the mines to the River Tees, and he saw there a massive entrepreneurial opportunity. He could charge the mine owners less than the horses and carts and still make a massive profit because, going back to productivity, this is a massive efficiency gain in transport. So this is how it worked. Entrepreneurs would select projects and then put their money where their mouth was. And this meant, of course, they had an incentive to only invest in economic projects. Some went wrong, of course, as they do with any entrepreneurial activity. But on the whole, this enabled this vast network to grow up in the 19th century. And then it started to go wrong, particularly during and after the First World War, when there was this big growth in state intervention and also a change in ideology when there's a shift towards a more interventionist mindset, partly because of the war and the war economy, the command and control mentality. And so since then, unfortunately, we've seen time and time again, not just politicians picking losers when they were trying to pick winners, but also going out of their way to stop private entrepreneurs from investing in infrastructure. So in the 1920s, the government deliberately stopped private investment in a new motorway network in the UK because they were trying to restrict competition for their favoured mode, which was the railway, so they had a hugely powerful lobby at the time.
HS2 is the obvious modern example of what seems certain to be a terrible failure of financial planning. What are some of the other big white elephants in recent years?
Well, the IA published a book about 10 years ago called They Meant Well, all about government project disasters. And there's a whole list of these terrible things like Concorde, the Millennium Dome, all these loss-making disasters that never made a profit. But I think one of the worst ones was civilian nuclear power, and that has cost the country hundreds of millions of pounds. It didn't deliver the cheap and abundant electricity it was supposed to. And we're still spending a fortune clearing up the mess now with the decommissioning programme, having to cover these things in concrete, and this is going to be a burden for generations to come.
One of the major criticisms of HS2 is that it's going to take so long to build that by the time it actually comes to fruition, the technology involved will be obsolete. We might have a huge amount of driverless car technology that means that the transport network as we see it today will no longer exist.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And often, you know, the private sector taking a more medium-term perspective rather than the very long-term one is completely rational because they understand that technology in these areas can shift dramatically. But I think also the other big problem is opportunity cost here, because if it's going to cost 60, 70, 80, 90 billion, then is it the best way of spending that huge amount of taxpayers' money? And even the government's own data suggests it isn't, that other schemes, particularly small-scale road schemes like bypasses, often have much better returns for the amount of money spent. So, you know, it's a massive misallocation of resources, and taxpayers are on the hook for it, unfortunately.
It would seem to many of us that cancelling HS2 would be a huge vote winner for any party that chooses to take it up. And yet there seems to be a big cross-party consensus behind the project. Why is that?
Well, if you remember back in 2013, the Labour Party, their top people started to go a bit soft on HS2. They'd ball saying, is this really the best way of spending 50 billion quid? And of course, it was once again the opportunity cost argument. And the problem was that they got a huge amount of pressure from the Northern councils who said, you've got to build this because, of course, the Northern councillors are going to get vast amounts of money pumped in on top of HS2 for these regeneration programmes around the stations and also for some of the local transport projects to link into HS2. I mean, these are all also appalling value for money schemes that are going to rip off taxpayers. But, of course, they do increase the status of these local politicians.
Is there any stopping HS2 now?
Well, I think it's quite likely there could be some kind of de-scoping. As costs go up and overruns build up, they could try and cut bits off the scheme, and hopefully they will cancel phase two, which makes little sense when you could easily speed up existing lines.
Jacob, do you buy the argument that decisions made further away from the source will always have worse outcomes?
Absolutely, yes. I think in general, government, when it intends to undertake a public policy decision of any sort, faces two types of problems from an economic viewpoint. One is knowledge, and the other one is incentives. Problem of knowledge is exactly what you referred to, that the further away you are from where the decisions actually made have an impact, the less you know about the local circumstances and the intrinsic factors or the particular factors that might affect it, other than in a very theoretical sort of blackboard context. You know, one thing is what it says on the Excel spreadsheet or whatever software model you're using, and the other thing is how it operates on the ground. And the second problem is incentives, which is much along the lines of what Richard was describing with regard to HS2, which is that, first of all, governments are not spending their own money. They don't really face a profit and loss incentive of any nature. And therefore, the incentives are elsewhere. They are to satisfy their particular political constituents, be it local councils, if you're the National Labour Party, or particular constituencies, if you're talking about individual MPs, or the very industries that might be servicing a lot of these projects. And that's where a lot of the crony capitalism that we've seen in recent years tends to come from. So certainly, yes, the more you remove the gains and losses from a decision and the source of information from the person making the decision, the worse in general the decisions you will tend to get.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.